Hello, friends. This episode of Long Roads is a catch-up call with my friend and co-founder of Notice, Cullen. We haven't seen each other for about 4 months as I've been stuck in Asia, but I'm finally back in LA, so we recorded this podcast remotely as I've been quarantining upon my return to the US. We discussed the past few months of isolation, or in my case, lack thereof, and how it's impacted us mentally and physically. We also talk about COVID-19's impact on the watch industry as a whole and how the ripples of the pandemic are being felt across the world. We discuss the roadmap until the end of the year and touch base on our upcoming projects. We have about a dozen projects that are in the pipeline. While it sounds like a lot, you'll hear why we've decided to push a little bit more aggressively during this strange period. Finally, we talk about the importance of having certainty in times of uncertainty. So without further ado, sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. Hey! So what are you doing for July 4th?
Practicing social distancing.
Nice.
No, because like what? The restaurants are closed, the bars are closed, the beaches are closed. What can you possibly do?
Yeah, true. Is your mom in town?
No.
No? So you're just going to stay home, barbecue with...
They will never come back here.
Yeah, probably not.
There's no point in coming back here because A, once you get here, you can't do jack shit. And then B, they probably won't be able to go back to China. Well, my mom's an American citizen, so yeah. They definitely won't allow Americans back in. Americans aren't allowed anywhere now, right?
Yeah, I think Europe just opened up, but they're not opening up to the US yet. And understandably so. I saw on one of the headlines this morning that 40 out of the 50 states are going up in cases.
Yeah, like who knew 6 months before this that the U.S. would be on a travel ban list with all the other major countries, including and along with like Syria and like Russia and all this shit.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's the U.S. right now.
Do you remember in November... I was at your place and we were probably doing something duality related, but you asked me, did you hear about that weird sickness that's coming out in Wuhan, China? And I responded, and at the time, obviously no one in America knew anything about it. And then I responded to you saying something along the lines of, oh yeah, I don't pay attention. It's not that important. Something like that. And then 3 months later, the entire world shuts down. It's pretty crazy how drastic this whole thing has been.
Yeah. You know, what's funny is that you came back. So you were trapped in Macau for like 3 months. But ironically, you know, you came from essentially, you know, where the China virus originated, right? And then you came back to a country where it's running rampant.
Yeah. I feel like maybe coming back wasn't the best idea. Now that I see how people are actually... kind of interacting with each other and the news and just, I don't know. I do think that there's a correlation between how quickly the virus drops off. If you look at the numbers, so there's a correlation between that and the control that the government has over the citizens. So that's kind of the reason why China can control it. Singapore can control it. You know, they can control this virus because they're able to get their citizens to behave in a certain way. Whereas here, you know, it's pretty sad and I feel like, I don't know, man. I don't even know the right words for it. I just feel like the fact that it's been going up in the majority of the country, there's literally just the Northeast that they kind of have it under control. It just shows that the US government doesn't have any control over the citizens, right? Where they're not able to do things and these are actions that only the government, something as big as the government can take to help ease the pain and kind of control the spread. You know, we can't leave it up to companies to do it. We can't leave it up to individuals to do it. I think the messaging, the education, all that was wrong. So it's just, the point I'm trying to make is that the difference between how Asians and Americans are dealing with it, it's night and day, you know, and I wasn't expecting the kind of lax attitude that everyone here has. And I'll tell you a story about how I came into the US. It's a really short story, literally 15 minutes from touchdown to getting my foot on pavement. That was it when I landed in LAX. So on
wait, were there no tests? No screening?
No, okay, so that's where I'm going. The on the flight, they gave out the US border control, the standard form. But with it, they gave out a health declaration form. And it looked very much like all the forms I've been filling out across Europe and all over Asia, going to KL and Singapore. And they all had the same questions. They were all questions of the same nature, which was, have you been to XYZ country in the past 14 days? Obviously the list of countries have changed as the virus has made its way around the world, but the nature of the question stayed the same. So I fill it out and I actually felt a bit of a sense of pride, because watching the news cycle in Asia, they kind of present the US as, kind of a laughingstock. They're like, look at these fools doing this, and this is how we did it and it's working here. And and seeing that happen, I was really embarrassed to be an American seeing the news make fun of the US in that way. And then I come back and I see them, they're actually, wow, there's a form. I'm surprised. I was fully expecting to get my temperature taken. And then I land. And because, there are probably like 20 planes that landed that day, right? LAX is a wasteland right now. So we land, the form is filled out. I walk out and I see three or four people in hazmat suits standing there. But they weren't like taking temperature or anything. They were holding some papers. So I automatically assumed that they were the people collecting these health forms. So I hand it to them. I say, hey, I believe this is for you. And they're like, oh, no, that's further along. I'm like, no, okay, that's kind of strange, but whatever. So I walk in and then get to the immigration part. And there's a lady and a man who are directing people to the right lanes for, international travelers plus mobile passport or whatever. So I did the mobile passport. So I tried to hand it to this lady too. And she's like, no, give it to immigration. I'm like, all right, that's also kind of strange. So I'm like, whatever. Go to immigration. And he scans everything touchless, which was cool. But mobile passport is pretty much always touchless. And I hand him the form when he's done doing his thing. And he's like, oh no, that's not for me. So I'm super confused by this point. I'm like, who am I giving this thing to? So I walk down, or I take the escalator down to baggage claim, and there are two cops standing there. And in my head, I'm like, there's no way that just, normal cops are going to be collecting this, but this is pretty much the last point that I have to pass, right? So I hand it to them. I go up to them and I didn't want to be weird about it, right? So I asked them, where's the restroom? And then at the end, I was like, by the way, do I give this form to you? And they're like, oh no, I don't even know what that is. So whatever, get my bag. And then, at the entrance or the exit rather of LAX, mm-hmm. they do that customs check where I actually don't even know what they do, but they pretend like they check something important. And I pull up to the lady and I'm like, and by the way, that line is usually really long, right? Mm-hmm. This one had no people, not a single body. So I pull up to the lady and I'm like, hey, you're the last stop, so this must be for you. And she says to me, no, actually, I just needed to see that you have it. And I'm like, excuse me? Like, what does that even mean? I have my address on here, and I thought it was supposed to be some kind of contact tracing kind of deal, right? Like if there's an outbreak, they can trace it back to my flight or even LAX or whatever, right? And they'd be able to either call me or have cops knock on my door and be like, hey, there's an outbreak and we traced it back to you. Or you've been in contact with someone that had COVID-19. None of that happened. They're just like, yeah, I just need to see that you have it. I'm like, so do you need the information on it? She's like, nope, that's just for you to keep. I'm like, what the fuck are you, what is this? No temperature checks. That's something else that was very different, right? Being in Macau, they have metal detectors everywhere, right? Naturally, mm-hmm. It's a casino, so they have metal detectors everywhere. But I noticed that none of them were even really on or working, but what was working and what was being powered were the thermal imaging cameras. So mm-hmm. they pretty much replaced metal detection with a thermal imaging camera, which to me looks like they see COVID-19 as a bigger threat than someone bringing weapons into a casino. Yeah, I know. It's I was speechless too. I was like, what is this nonsense?
Yeah, so you were in Macau for like 3 months.
Yeah.
And then so you were obviously keeping up with the news about America. So now you've been in America for about what, 2 weeks?
Yeah, about 2 weeks.
So how has the experience been, and how has the experience aligned with what you've read in the media, your everyday life?
Yeah. Well, like I said, in the media over in Asia, you know, the US is kind of presented as a laughingstock. And in many ways, it's pretty appropriately framed, because coming here, I do see that there's a lack of nuance in how they're handling the virus. In the beginning, I think it was even worse, right, where they looked at coronavirus across the entire United States. But, you know, one of the best things, and to a degree, it's also one of the worst things about the country, is that you can drive literally 1 to 2 hours and you're in a totally different environment, culture, and population density. You know, whereas a place like Hong Kong is pretty homogeneously populated. So they can make broad brushstroke rules and have people follow all these rules, and you should see some kind of result. And the US government can't do that, right? The federal government can't do that because of how huge this country is.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, not to mention, like, I don't want to make this political, but there's also, you know, there's a competence issue right now in leadership about how they're handling this. And to be honest, I actually don't think there has been any so-called handling of this virus yet in the US.
It's not political whatsoever. It's just an objective observation. The only people calling it political are the idiot sheep, which is funny because you heard about those people, the officer in Oregon or whatever, saying, "Oh, I'm not going to wear a mask. Don't be a sheep."
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Like, in the US, pretty much everything you do, whether it's wearing a mask has turned into wearing a MAGA hat. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And regardless of where you align politically, wearing a mask should never be politically charged. It should be about health and precautions. And I remember, like, in the beginning, right, they were lying. The CDC basically said that they're telling everyone masks don't do anything.
That was the very first step. That was the very first step into this failure.
Like, yeah, and to a certain degree, I understand why they did that, right? Is because they didn't have PPE prepared. So they were lying to the public so that the public wouldn't purchase all these masks at scale and hoard it, so that the people taking care, like on the front lines who needed it, they were the ones that that got it. That was the intent. And Fauci even came out and said that. You know, he said that, but there's a speech that is to be made, that should be made by someone in a position of leadership, saying, yes, we lied, and this is why we lied, but moving forward, this is how we're going to handle it. We encourage you to wear masks, but we encourage you to also not hoard hundreds of them, you know, so that we can actually get masks to the right people. Because now, actually, the number of cases now is worse than it was back then, obviously, right?
Yep.
And now it's critical that the people that need the masks get it, right? Like, Texas is at or over capacity now, right? Like Houston, and I suspect LA is going to be there soon. Florida is at 10,000 cases a day now, which was New York at its worst, you know?
Arizona's dead.
Yeah. It's horrible. And there's no real concentrated effort as far as the federal government goes. You know, I know I saw that Trump reinstated the pandemic response team, but it's a little bit too little too late, you know?
Well, they're absolutely useless if Trump doesn't even want to listen to them.
Yeah.
And he literally practices the opposite of what they preach. And he's obviously, he is the reason why the country is in the state that it is in right now. It starts from the top. People tend to listen to the president regardless of how dumb the president is. And if he doesn't wear a mask, then other people will follow.
Yeah.
But regarding what you said about the CDC and saying don't wear a mask in the very beginning, back in like February, March, the issue, that is an issue itself, because they had to say that because the hospitals wouldn't be able to get their hands on PPE properly because of the way it's set up. And that itself is a huge issue in the States. And then the very fact that when the government tries to, supply PPE to the hospitals, we all know what happened.
Yeah.
Like, freaking FEMA hoarded all of it themselves just so they can dish it out to the highest paying person. Doesn't matter like which state needs it the most, whoever pays the most from will pay FEMA. And then that money will go to, certain son-in-law of Trump, and then they'll line their pockets with more money because that's just how America works now.
Yeah, it's all corrupted. And but I mean, it's not something that we didn't know, right? It's just that right now it's floating to the top because of what's happening in the news. But like I said earlier, right, I do think there's a correlation between how quickly countries can get this thing under control and the control that they have over their citizens. If you look at the numbers in Canada, culturally, it's, there are definitely differences between Canada and the US in terms of culture, but in many ways, there's also a lot of similarities.
Yep.
But how is it that a country like Canada has had such a much better handle on this from the get-go than the US? And I'm interested to see if in some weird, bizarre world, if Canada was in the position that the US was in, where they have an astronomical number of cases, how quickly they'd be able to get it down, right? I'm willing to bet that they probably won't be able to get it down quite as quickly because I think in terms of the government and how people perceive the government, I don't think they have as much control over their city. Like, freedom is still a thing in Canada to a certain degree, right? Definitely not like in the US. But Canada knew that, right? They knew that instead of trying to recover from a really shitty state, why don't we try to contain this thing, right? They close the borders, they, implement mask wearing policies and all that kind of jazz that has been proven scientifically with data that it actually helps, But
what is science? What is data? What is facts?
Yeah, it's decades worth of people being proven wrong.
So the real pandemic in the United States is ignorance and just anti-science, just a willing dismissal of everything that's true.
Yeah.
Just to believe in what makes them feel good, which is ridiculous. And Trump really brought that out of people. He really encouraged that type of thinking. And now this is why we see so many more, like there's such a bigger prevalence of them in the States. Like it always existed, but now it's like people are encouraged to act ignorant out loud.
Yeah, you're right. And everything is really politically charged now, right? Like, remember we posted a black square on Instagram, and the intent for us was really that, it's human rights. You know what I mean? It's not a political thing, but for some stupid ass reason, and I knew this was going to happen, which is why I made sure to disable comments. For some stupid reason, people saw it as a political statement saying that you're anti-Trump or what. I don't even know what political statement that it possibly could have been. But from our point of view, it was literally just saying, hey, they're people too. Black people, Mexican people, Chinese people, we're all people, and we should all be treated equally and have equal rights and equal access to opportunity. And, I find it so sad that we even have to say something like that in 2020. But the fact is that posting that one little black square turned into a political argument, and then we lost a bunch of followers and,
not that it matters.
No, of course not. I don't give a shit, man. I don't look at that stuff, but it's still, like the fact that we lost followers, I think it's pretty interesting to see how, how politically charged everything has become, politically charged, racially charged. It's a very weird, kind of strange world to be living in. Not that it was not this way before I left, but and this is one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about. Like on the flight coming home, I had all these expectations, and then actually being here, it feels like I came back to a different world. Like the energy and the vibe here, it's very different. After 4 months of being in Asia and seeing this huge kind of cultural recalibration happen across the pond and actually across the entire world, this happened too, right? Now coming back here, it feels like the U.S. is forcing themselves into like motions of normalcy just to distract from the very real issue that we have still like right in front of our face, you know? That's why things opened up when they shouldn't have. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's a very strange world, or a strange country, I should say, because the rest of the world is going back to normal now.
It all starts from the top.
Yeah.
If the top can't
support... How about you, man? You've been stuck here. You know, I know things at Notice have been at a standstill, but like real quick, personally, let's move to greener pastures for the time being. What have you been up to?
It's not green for me, man. Like, I'm feeling the exact same way millions of other Americans have been feeling, which is I'm getting really fucking sick of this quarantine. But yeah. I took it very seriously in the first 3 months, the first 100 days. Mm-hmm. Like, I went out to eat 3 times maybe.
Yeah.
And it was like fast food. And I was in my apartment pretty much every single day, except for fulfillment. Wore my mask every single place. Literally had hand sanitizer everywhere. I hand sanitized after every touching anything. So I was really good about it. Socially distanced, I didn't see anyone, right? But it takes a mental toll on you.
Yeah.
And that's what so many other people were feeling. And then without actual strict enforcement of like staying in place, and then with everything opening, you just want to go out. You just want to, you know, go to restaurants, you want to go to bars, you just want to go back to a normal life, because, you know, life stuck at home is really shitty.
Yeah.
Even for an introvert like me, like I enjoyed it for the first 3 months, but then now I'm like feeling like, okay, I'm over it and I just want to go out. But obviously I haven't, because I know it's just getting worse now because of everything yeah. opened, and then we had the protests, and then now we have a huge second peak.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's still ramping up. Yeah. I was telling Chris, one of our friends, Chris Wren, you know, he was asking just generally how things were going. And what I said was that, you know, like you and I actually saw each other. So for people listening, you and I saw each other, but we didn't hug. We didn't shake hands. We were standing 6 feet apart. I handed you a thing and then, you know what I mean? Like, it was the strangest hello again, good to see you I've ever done.
I would have, like, if this pandemic wasn't here, I would have picked you up at the airport. I would have chilled with you for like a week straight. But like now I just don't know what to do.
Yeah. And so I was telling Chris, like, you know, you're one of the most mentally strong people I know. And the fact that this is taking a toll on your mental health, just think about all the people in the United States who still have to practice this physical distancing thing, you know, and I feel for them. I personally haven't felt it yet because I've literally just been doing this for 2 weeks. Like Macau and Hong Kong and Singapore, it's life like normal because they never had more than a couple thousand cases. You know?
Yeah, I was saying, like, you're so lucky. Like, you didn't have to really do a real quarantine. Like, you were going out to restaurants. I was like, fuck you when you sent me these photos. I was so jealous. I was like, oh my God, going to a restaurant and like ordering food. Like, that's something that's so foreign to me.
Like, that's a thing though. Yeah, that's a thing. Like in the beginning, I had to do that 14-day quarantine because you know, going into Macau, and that to me, I mean, honestly, it was kind of nice. Like the worst part was my parents would go out and do things, and then they would have to bring food home for me. Like I know what it feels like to be a dog now.
You were a dog,
like,
yeah.
waiting for my owner to come home, and that was about it. It was actually pretty nice. I watched YouTube. I played a bunch of guitar.
Well, 2 weeks
did
is
some
fine.
Design stuff with you. Yeah, and it's only 2 weeks, but once that was done, like, I put shoes on after 2 weeks. Man, the bottom of my feet were so smooth after not wearing shoes for 2 weeks, not walking anywhere. I literally took, like, 17 and a half steps a day. But yeah, like, we just went straight back to normal, went out and did things, went to restaurants. The gym was open. By the time I left, swimming pools were open. You know, so it still felt very much, I can't say normal, because you still had to take your temperature everywhere you went. You had to wear a mask. You had to, you know, there are certain things that were a bit different, but I was still able to do things.
That's
so
a small
now
price
back
to pay.
This, it's a very small price to pay. And it's a price I'm willing to pay. And that's a price that we could have paid here if it was handled differently.
My biggest concern is this toxic masculinity that's so prevalent here. It's like, apparently wearing a mask is shows that you're weak.
Apparently.
I've never equated the two to be like even related whatsoever.
Yeah.
You know, like it has nothing to do with being weak. It's just a health concern. So like,
yeah, there's probably like some kind of fear, right? If you show that you're afraid of something and you're fearful of something, that shows that you have weakness, you know, because part of being a man is being tough and daring and ballsy.
You know? You can really see this in someone like Joe Rogan, right? He's like a very typical, like, oh, like macho masculine. And he to this day, I don't listen to him all the time, but I know that he has been anti-mask.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's really concerning because a lot of people listen to him, look up to him. And we have these really influential people just saying no mask, no mask. Or like master for pussies.
Yeah. So the deal with Joe Rogan, that's a pretty interesting thing. Right? Like what happened was he invited Bill Burr onto the show and he was trying to egg him on, trying to stimulate some kind of rant from Bill Burr. Because that's what he's known for, is angry old man rants.
Yeah.
So Joe Rogan was saying things like, yeah, don't wear a mask. It's not manly. You're being weak. But in actuality, Joe Rogan actually does wear a mask when he goes out and does all this shit. It's just that that doesn't make headlines, right? It makes headlines when you see a humongous tattooed up bald man that commentates on cage fighting, right? That fits his brand a lot better. I mean, and this has been happening for so long. Everyone thinks he's always been right wing or super conservative, but if you actually listen to him speak and look at his values, and it shows that he actually is very left-wing and he does a lot of things that the left would condone.
But regardless, like that's not a position someone like him should be taking up, because he influences people. Like he is a major figure for many people.
Is probably the media, like just trying to make headlines, you know, people would just recontextualize things to get more eyeballs. And I think that's what happened here. And we've been seeing that happen all 2020.
Yeah.
So how do we take this to greener pastures? Can we, any updates with family? I can give you my update. My dad is quitting his job in Macau and moving back to Seattle. So I'll finally be closer to my family again. At least on the same time zone.
I won't be able to see my parents until 2021, probably.
Mm.
They're not going to come.
Anything good at all that came out of this?
No.
Nothing.
And it's only going to get worse. We all know that. You know?
Yeah.
Like, I hate to be such a negative Nancy, but we know what's coming. The economy is... The stock market has no indication of the economy. It's all fake.
Yeah.
There's going to be, you know, July it ended, right? So no more extra unemployment benefits for the people. The CERT, it's surging.
I think they just extended that today.
Certain states have extended, like California extended it. But California is already so deeply in debt. They have no money.
Yeah.
How are they getting this? Where are they getting this money from?
Yeah, who knows?
So
we're going to pay for it later. They're probably printing it and then we'll have to pay in tax later.
Yeah, that's obviously what's going to happen. And that's how it is. I'll try to think of something green. Just give me a second.
What? Anything in your lifestyle that you've changed lately? Like,
dude, I can't.
Other than staying home, but like, are you?
I can't go to the gym. I've lost weight. Yeah. All right. I'll try to be positive. Just let me think of something. The past month has been quiet. I've been doing a lot of designing, which is really nice. You know, that's pretty much like, we've always said like, that's pretty much the highlight of this job, I think, is designing something.
Among others. Yeah.
But like, that's like one of the best parts, because you really get to get the creative juices flowing. You get to, you know, get what's from your mind and put onto paper and then into real life. And that's really, really, that's mm-hmm. gratifying. So I've been doing a lot of designing. We have a lot of cool stuff coming up. Yeah. Really, really excited for some of the stuff that we've designed.
Yeah. And I do want to come back to that towards the end of the podcast.
We will.
Just go in depth a little bit more. But other than that, in terms of like your lifestyle, are you, you're obviously you're cooking at home more. One thing I noticed was that you're actually cooking pretty things that you usually wouldn't make.
Yeah, for right? sure. Because, but like, I'm getting tired of that now, you know? Mm-hmm. Like this lifestyle is hard to sustain. I want to go out.
Yeah.
So I've been trying to go on more, like more walks, hiking and stuff like that. I miss the gym, surprisingly. I never like going to the gym, but I miss it.
Yeah.
The gym in my apartment complex actually opened again.
Oh, it did?
You had to sign up like for your slot and only three people at a time in the gym. But
wow.
It's good. I'm glad they're enforcing such strict rules. But
yeah. Yeah, it's annoying.
It's still gross.
Yeah.
What else? Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't think I have anything positive to say. I don't want to I think right now
guitar
you're the more you're yeah of course yeah. of course but I miss my electric, but I don't have an amp and I can't really play out loud in my apartment.
Yeah That's true.
So I hope to change that this year. I do want a new electric guitar, I know that, but
have you decided which one yet?
No, I'm probably gonna flip-flop, but I want a PRS because like
yeah,
I just want to get something good and not have to think about it and know the guitar for a long time. And I think a PRS brings me that type of it's versatile. It looks great. It'll last forever. And most importantly, it's just so sexy.
Yeah, they're great, man. We should try to go to their factory and try a bunch of guitars and see how it's made and do the whole tour.
Where's the factory, Maryland?
When we can.
Where is it?
Is it Maryland or is it Virginia? Somewhere on the East Coast.
Yeah.
But GNL's factory is in Fullerton. We can go there too.
Fullerton.
I need to get my nut switched out.
Excuse me? what kind of nut is it? It's the self-lubricating nut, right?
I believe it's GrafTech, but they didn't glue it down properly, so it kind of, you know how it's like loose, right? So I want to change it out to a black nut and then have them glue it in properly.
Is a black nut better?
No, I just like the look of it better.
So it's also GrafTech, black GrafTech, right?
Yeah, also GrafTech, but against the maple neck, I think a black nut would pop really nicely.
And then the Fender factory is in Corona, right? Corona, California.
Is it? I feel like they kind of pulled out all manufacturing brought it to Mexico.
I have no idea, but I also want to go to the Taylor factory down in San Diego.
Yeah, we should do that.
That one's I think I've told you like I wanted to go to that like for the past like how many months, but like it's obviously impossible now.
Yeah. Well, how long do you think this is gonna go? And on the other side of it, where three places or three things that you want to do that you can't do because of quarantine.
Well, this is not going to end. Like normalcy won't resume until there's a vaccine. So ideally, end of the year. There's no.
You think it'll come that soon?
That's the only thing I'm trying to be optimistic about. But there's going to be no wind up in New York. Right. Even though they haven't canceled it yet, I really doubt they're going to do it because New York is going to. His Cuomo is like putting his. He's putting the hammer down. Which is good. So there's not going to be big events. So I don't think things are going to return to normal until ideally end of the year, early next year. And then we can start going out doing normal things again. What I want to do, first thing I want to do is travel. I need to get out of this place.
Out of the US or you want to travel domestically?
Out of the US, ideally. Go somewhere in Europe, if they allow us.
Big if.
I want to go somewhere in Europe.
Germany.
maybe like Southern Italy or Spain or something.
Yeah.
And then second thing, I want to do all those things that we talked about. Go to all the factories, you know, just go places, go to fucking Joshua Tree. Yeah. We haven't been there yet together.
Yeah.
I mean, we can go now, but it's
ideally we shouldn't.
It's really crowded too, apparently. I mean, cause everyone wants to go out into the nature.
Yeah.
And three, I want to go to bars. I want to sit down on my ass and drink beer again at a bar, you know, like order at the front and have someone pour it for me and then like drink it.
Yeah. Sitting at a bar, man, took it for granted, right? But like actually sitting at a bar and having a beer, watching, talking to the bartender, watching the bartender pour the beer. There's something so romantic about that now, like from a land far, far away.
Yeah. And I want to do a notice get together party, because we haven't done anything this year besides from the tour earlier this year, but nothing domestically. And I feel really disconnected from all of our notice fam. So it'd be really great to do another end of the year party if that's even realistic.
Yeah, I know what you mean, man. Yeah, I guess for me, I'm pretty much done traveling, at least internationally for the year, you know, after the Euro tour and then the Asia tour. I think that's enough miles yeah, go ahead.
I want to go up to Seattle with you.
Yeah, so that's what I was going to say.
Yeah.
Parents moving back, and you know, there's a stat floating around somewhere, probably on Reddit, that by the time you graduate from high school, you spent 80% of your time with your parents in your entire life already. And it's probably true for the most part, but I want to do everything in my power now that they're, you know, approaching their 60s, do more with them, spend more time with them. And them moving back to Seattle just makes it easier, you know, more of an excuse to go up and hang out there and spend time with them.
They're so close.
Yeah. You know, it's still a flight away or a long drive, but you know, for the way that you and I grew up, it's like next door pretty much.
So where's the closest airport to their home? Like, is it still Tacoma?
No. So Everett has a airport there. It's maybe 10 to 15 minutes away from the home.
And would you ever fly direct into there?
Yeah, I've done it before. Can you? Yeah, from Long Beach. So right here in Long Beach, again, the airport's like 15-ish minutes away. So it's actually a very, very easy flight. Pretty affordable.
That sounds great.
You know, JetBlue. I love JetBlue. So, but I'm, you know, regardless, I'm probably not going to fly regardless of all the precautions that the airlines are taking. Like flying internationally, I'm perfectly comfortable with it. But flying domestically, definitely not. So
yeah, because they're all packed. They pack them like fucking rats into a little cage.
Yeah, I mean, big airlines like United and American, they're not doing anything, you know, to protect their customers. But it's just another example.
They don't need to do anything.
Yeah, they don't need to. They're too big. But it's another example, sort of like the new Tudor Blue Black Bay 58 is another example of how misaligned the big corporations' incentives are with their customers. They just don't give a shit. They do what they want.
Wait, so you hate it? You hate that watch?
I mean, I can't hate it. It's a good looking watch, but I hate the brand for doing it. I hate Tudor for doing that because what, they spent 2 years working out the perfect blue formula, Pantone, whatever. Like, come on.
No.
You know,
they're just milking the money.
I think what they wanted to do was release the black one, get people excited, release a dud, which they did last year, and then put out a blue one to recoup all that money. But it's because they have enough cash where they can think that long term. But the entire thing was a fabricated, manufactured type of hype machine that they were doing. But you know, people don't think about it that way. They just say, oh, there's a blue watch and I like it. Because watches
they just eat it up.
Fundamentally emotional purchases.
I just find it so funny how like the reception was wildly positive.
Yeah.
But I mean, But we look at it from a different perspective.
Yeah, for right? sure. Yeah.
We're not the average consumer just buying a luxury watch. Mm-hmm. But like, I just find it really funny. I'm like, oh, this is so amazing. Like, oh my God, I got to have it.
Yeah.
It's like, it's just a blue watch.
Yeah. Well, I think I mentioned to you on the last time we were on the podcast together and probably several times in between, but I mentioned how when the whole pandemic thing started, it, you know, obviously it hit Asia first and then it went to Europe shortly after. It didn't really gain traction in the US until a little bit later. But when Baselworld was canceled in Switzerland, a lot, actually before it was canceled, a lot of brands like Bulova and, you know, whatever, just a bunch of the random Swiss brands that aren't at the scale of brands like Rolex and Omega, they started pulling out early. And well, Omega, it wasn't going anyways, but you know what I mean, right? Like the smaller independent Swiss brands were pulling out. And what I was hearing was that it's because the supply chain was already affected in Asia, right? So they couldn't get the prototypes from China in time. So they had to pull out. And the cost that they would have to pay if they didn't pull out would be basically an admission that, you know, they don't have anything. Their supply chain was affected by COVID-19. Because at the time, the supply chain in Europe was wide open. So I guess there was a worry that people would connect the dots. So instead of just showing up and you know, showing drawings or something like that, they just pulled out altogether. And this theory was corroborated when I went to London and I had drinks with some, you know, fellow brand owners who actually share supply chain with large companies that are owned by Citizen and Swatch Group and whatever. And a lot of them were actually trying to poach him to introduce the engineers and the designers to a whole new supply chain that is solely dedicated to smaller brands, even within Europe. So to me, it feels like this huge contraction might actually be a blessing in disguise for this segment of the market, and probably for other industries as well, that there are segments of those industries that I think are vastly benefiting on the back of all of this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the big companies definitely have taken notice with this segment of the market under 1,000, like the small independent brands.
Yeah.
And, you know, we might be seeing more competition from the bigger brands in the form of like either new brands or like off brands of, or sister brands of the bigger companies.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they've tried before, right? Like Baumann, Mercier, they launched Bomb. And it bombed.
Well, it's a dress watch. You can't compete with a dress watch.
Yeah, that's true.
Right. So I think they got that part wrong.
Well, that's kind of the point I'm making, right? They're so out of touch with this segment of the market and just generally speaking, out of touch with watch enthusiasts and people that love watches. Mm-hmm. Like obviously the new blue Black Bay, it was really popular for watch enthusiasts, but if you actually break down the number of people buying it, it's probably 99% non-watch enthusiasts that are buying Tudor, not the watch, right? Whereas watch enthusiasts would rather buy the watch, but you know, there's just so at that price point, especially with such a vanilla kind of design, watch enthusiasts aren't looking for something like that anymore, you know?
Well, if you go on Hodinkee and look at the comment section, that design resonates with a lot of people.
Yeah, but is Hodinkee really representative of real watch enthusiasts? I mean, come on. They're an official retailer for Apple Watch now. You see that article?
It's a money-making...
And, I mean,
it's a money-making machine.
Hodinkee. It is. But again, once you reach a certain scale, most companies no longer have incentives aligned with their consumers and the market. And it's very sad to see that. I mean, they're obviously outliers, right? But far and few between. For the most part, once you reach a certain size, I don't see any company that really stay true to who they are and stay true to their customers and serve them the way they did when they were small and nimble.
Yeah, because they don't need to.
Yeah, because they don't need to. And also because shareholders and bottom line is what matters more than actually creating something meaningful. But I mean, that's why I'm always and forever going to love this segment of the industry. And, you know, it's why I have so much respect for people like Jason and Bill. And speaking of Jason, actually, I'm wearing my new watch, my Helios Tropic. I haven't taken this thing off, my Tropic B. I haven't taken it off since I got it.
Yeah. I just love how we got that used off Watch You Seek from one of our customers as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you email him and told him who we are?
Well, when I messaged him on WatchySeek, I'm like, hey, dude, like, it's me.
Yeah.
Because we've talked before, and I'm like, can I buy your watch? He's like, oh, yeah, cool.
Yeah. And he ended up buying a bunch of our new Tech Tough straps.
Yeah. So it's a funny world when that happens. It's just a funny interaction.
Yeah. Well, I also just want to say, just so we have it in permanent record, that I don't care what Jason says about this watch. This is his best design.
Yeah.
I
like it too.
Humble opinion. There's something so bold and sleek and unique.
There's nothing else like that in the market.
No, yeah, not at all.
Nothing else like that. It's really bold and very unique.
Yeah. Yeah. But this is a keeper for me for sure. I fucking love this thing.
You have a lot of keepers now, huh?
Yeah, I do. But that's, you know, good. I do think I'm on like a kind of a fixed bezel kind of thing, right? Because I was wearing the Duality for a while, which isn't a fixed bezel, but it can kind of get away with it. But then I put on the Crucible and then the Triumph and the Field. And then this guy, I don't find myself reaching for divers anymore. I wore the Retrospect for about 20 minutes yesterday. And, you know, it's a pretty nice watch, but I don't want a bezel anymore. Like, what am I going to do?
That's the general trend, right? Yeah. Right now for this segment of the market is just trending towards simplicity.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why you see that the Seiko 5 fixed bezel sport watch is so, I guess the reception has been really good.
Yeah.
Even though I personally think it's really ugly.
Yeah, it looks like an incomplete design, doesn't it?
Yeah, Seiko has been doing an excellent job listening to this part of the market.
Yes.
They're definitely scouring the forums or Instagram. Like, they know what's up.
Yeah.
And you can tell with their designs that they're really appealing to the micro brand owner, I would say.
Well, that's why they increase prices too, right? They don't want to be seen as the entry-level budget brand from enthusiasts anymore.
Well, I've said this many times before, like, they're finally priced where they should have been priced.
Yeah.
They were undervalued. They underpriced their watches for far too long.
Yeah.
Like, the fact that you can get like a Sumo for like $300 doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah.
With that quality of finishing, that case, the movement, the loom, you can get it for like $350.
Yeah.
If you look around. Like, that's insane. But now it's priced more reasonably at like $600-$700.
Mm-hmm.
But then I do think their newer stuff, like the new divers, the that 62 MAS looking one, and then the 6105 looking one, they're priced at $1,200, which I think is a bit on the high end.
Yeah.
But people are absolutely loving it. You know, good for them.
Yeah.
Good for Seiko.
Yeah, I wonder where they go from here. I have a lot of thoughts on Seiko, but more broadly about Japan in general, because they're, I guess, officially in a recession, but I guess the US is too.
They've been in a recession for like 30 years, dude.
Yeah. Well, I think, so I listened to a podcast about this, and in the 90s, I'll try to keep it short, but in the 90s, they basically started a precedence for the general consumer market, expecting that prices are going to go down, right? Because they're in a state of deflation, which is the opposite of the US, where we've been inflating for so long, right? So people are almost expecting prices to go up in the US, right? People expect to pay more next year than they're going to be paying this year. And that's a trend that we see in the watch industry, right? When a brand comes out, they always increase their prices, which I think is a very important thing to do. Some brands increase prices because inflation, but there are also other aspects that those brands are considering, right? They're improving their quality and their supply chain. But in Japan, it's pretty much the opposite, where consumers expect to pay less next year than they are this year. And you kind of see that reflected in their prices, right? Being so cheap, trying to, you know, garner the attention of the Japanese market. But I don't think they can do that anymore. I think they finally realize that there's a market outside Japan that they need to pay attention to. And for the most part, Americans and Europeans and Southeast Asians are willing to pay for a Seiko.
Yep. And again, I think that whole Grand Seiko, them separating from the Seiko brand has really elevated the perception of Seiko as well. I mean, that's, you see that across many industries when, you know, companies do that. So it was, the price is, I guess, justified for the increase. And they have that new movement as well. Whether or not you think it's worth it is another, is another issue, but you know, they're doing their, you know, they're doing the right things, I think, for a brand, and they're releasing exciting watches. Like they released a lot of new stuff this year, really exciting stuff. And as an enthusiast, like that's all you can ask for, which is why I'm disappointed in Tudor, which just, this time and they released a blue watch of a blue version. Wow.
Yeah, it's horrible. I don't think that Tudor really has any reason to exist anymore. You know, like they're not really doing enough, right? Making watches is never enough. There needs to be an overarching purpose for your company to be here. And, you know, they're selling well now. At least it looks that way. But long term, I'm not sure how they're going to do, because right now the people buying them are, you know, for the sake of argument, and obviously there are a lot of people who are really educated about the watch industry who are buying them, but for the majority of their revenue, it's not coming from people who know much about watches. They just have access, easy access to Tudor or, you know, fill in the blank. And the more someone learns about Tudor, and you know, I love Tudor, I love Omega too, but the more you learn about these brands, the more you can see that they don't really have your best interests at heart. They're not really innovating in their design or in their technology. They're not really doing interesting things anymore. And to me, that's a pretty boring, cold, bleak place to live. You know, so that's why, like, I don't really have any interest in buying any of those big Swiss brands, right? Like my last acquisition, other than this Tropic, was my dad's Grand Seiko, the SBGN, like 221 or something. I don't know. Reference numbers are weird. But like, I'm not even a super dressy person, but I have this appreciation for this design and the craftsmanship. And I love that watch, and I've been wearing it. I feel like a dad when I wear it, but, you know, I love it nonetheless.
You look like a grandpa when you wear it, not a dad. That got that crocodile strap, Jesus.
Yeah, I think all I need to do is throw it on a rubber and then beat the shit out of it, and then it'll be properly mine.
You know, to be honest, I have zero interest in buying any Swiss watches right now either.
Yeah. Do you have any interest in buying watches in general? Because I'm tapped out for probably the next 12 months.
I've never been more excited for our upcoming watches than I ever have at any previous point in my life.
Really? Okay. So do you want to talk some specifics? Obviously, we can't give too much away, but I think it'd be interesting to talk about why you're so excited now about our creations.
It's because now I feel besides all the COVID delays that the whole industry is facing, just some of the innovations that we've done and the quality parts as well as quality materials and finishing that we're going to implement in the upcoming watches is giving me everything that you can get in a $3,000 Swiss watch, but in a way better package, a way more affordable, fun package, I would say.
Yeah.
And that scratches my itch for needing a high-end watch, because, I mean, I already have some high-end watches. It's just they're all Japanese. But these upcoming watches that we're going to release will scratch that itch for my need for a Swiss luxury watch.
Yeah.
And what do you want? Which one do you want to talk about?
Well, I want to talk about the actual models and design in a second, but before that, can you speak more to what you're alluding to as far as quality and construction go? Because, I mean, for us, we've always been chasing good quality since day negative one. Like before any of this started, the number one thing we wanted was good quality, great quality, best quality. You know what I mean? Absolute best quality.
Beautiful quality.
That was me trying to do a Trump. Yeah. I did the fingers too.
Beautiful, the most amazing, most genius
tremendous quality.
Yeah, absolutely gorgeous. That word.
Anyways, but you know what I mean though. Like that's something we've been chasing since the beginning. But and we've been progressing ever since the beginning, right? Every release has been better quality this or better quality that, or the engineering method was different, or the But what's different now? Like, why is it so different now than it was in the past? And what new things in particular are you excited about that we're trying as far as the technicalities go?
Okay, so the more tangible things, we finally have, we've been buying our own loom, finally. Mm-hmm. We have our own loom. We can use the same loom for the hands, the dial, the bezel, so they can finally match. Yep. One of the hardest things to do is getting suppliers to have matching loom, whether that's color, intensity, whatever. But we got the finest stuff straight from RC Tritech, so I'm really excited to get that, put that into use.
Yeah, and let's not say what it is specifically, just because it's fairly new, and we're gonna do a blog about it and everything. So it's cool.
It's cool.
It's not BGW and it's not C3.
I'm excited to see how that turns out. The second thing is, we'll try a new method of brushing to get that Holy Trinity type of look, as well as Omega. Just the Swiss rough. What do you call it? Silicone.
Like the deeper
silicone brushing.
Yeah. So it's like deeper brush strokes, shorter brush strokes. So it catches the light a bit differently and kind of really shimmers.
Yeah. Excited to try that out. We are designing a new clasp, a proprietary clasp, from the ground up, essentially. And it's in prototyping right now.
With an extension and...
Extension, whatnot. Everything that you need in a clasp.
It's like the perfect clasp. If we were to have one clasp to rule them all, this would be the one.
Yeah, we did. We spent a lot of time looking at, different mechanisms. And now it's hopefully, the real life application of it will be good. We'll see. Yeah. And then
we worked with our good friend and mechanical engineer Ethan, known as Geekster on Instagram.
Yep.
That was a lot of fun.
So hopefully we can get that out into one of our releases by the end of the year / early next year. But that's going to be, that's going to be really, really, that's all. I'm just looking forward to that thing, man.
Yeah.
And then another thing that's changed, I think, is just over time we've developed a better sense of how drawings translate to real life and what small details really change the overall feel of a watch. And those small details are being implemented into our new designs. And it'll result in something that's just completely different in feel and just look and quality. Like small, tiny changes, like little tiny chamfers there, or like, just stuff like that, that is kind of hard to grasp at first when you don't have experience.
Yeah.
But now that we do, it's... definitely going to be interesting, and we're also trying new mechanisms that we haven't tried before, like on our upcoming pilot watch, for example. We're trying a bi-directional like friction bezel, right?
Yep.
Is that giving away too much?
I'm really excited for the I think we can be pretty open about it. I want to document at least one model, and people kind of know that the pilot is coming out. Yeah. So I was going to say that might be like the perfect one to try to start documenting our process, so people kind of know what to expect.
Yeah. So the challenge right now is getting that perfect feel for a friction bezel, because you don't want it to be too loose. Mm-hmm. You don't want it to be too tight.
Yeah.
You want it just right, like Goldilocks,
Yeah.
And then
using a new movement, right? The NH36.
I forgot about this part. Yeah, it's going to be a day date watch.
Yeah.
But it's not going to be
our first day date.
Our first day date, but the way it's implemented is going to be really freaking exciting for people, I think. It's going to make people who don't like day date probably like day date, because it actually works well with the design.
Yeah.
Symmetrical.
Yep.
And it makes sense.
Yeah. That was a really good job of hinting without giving it away.
Yeah. Also raised markers. They're not applied, but they're raised and then printed on top. So it's like a 3D Arabic numeral type of look. So that's giving away more. And then obviously different textures on the dial. it's a sector, so there's also a sector in it. So we got different finishes, different looks for just an overall really exciting freaking watch.
Yeah. We're also working with another movement for the first time. Do you want to talk to that?
Oh, yeah. So people's wishes have finally come true. I think we're going to do a GMT. Very limited, though, but it's a good start to see the reception. It's a, SW330?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we'll see how that goes. It's going to be really fun to turn that model into a GMT model.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What else is there? How are you feeling about the Avalon 2? I think we can talk a bit about that one. Obviously, don't give too much away, but...
Yeah, I mean, we'll have a portion of it in a different material, case material, so that's a first for us.
Yeah.
I'm excited, man.
Yeah. So what I was trying to get to was that we're doing a bunch of things for the first time, kind of all at once, because historically, the way we've done it is when we try something new, we do it... We just focus on that and then kind of, you know, see how it goes, experiment, see if there's any reject rate that we need to take into account or any difficulties in engineering and manufacturing. But, you know, with the pandemic, we've kind of doubled down on how aggressive we're being in, you know, kind of pushing the boundaries of the under $1,000 market. You know, not just in terms of design, but in terms of actual manufacturing and engineering these parts. And, you know, we'll definitely do a more in-depth episode in particular about each model and what we've done differently, and definitely a blog post to explain it. But I think just on a kind of a macro level, going aggressive at a time when everyone is kind of pulling back and holding their cards closer to their chest, I feel like we are being extremely risky here. In the best of ways, though, right?
Mm-hmm.
Warren Buffett even says, like, when everyone's scared, you should be aggressive, and when everyone is fearless, you should pull back. So, something along those lines. But that's, in a way, what we're doing, right? We're putting a lot of capital and time and exploring a whole bunch of different things with our engineers. And it's really exciting. And I think that's probably why we feel the same way, I think. And I think it's just really exciting, you know, just being able to try all these different things when, for the most part, we should be slowing down. You know what I mean?
I mean, like I said, like, I don't think I've ever been this excited.
Yeah.
So what about the Avalon 2 would you want to reveal? I'm trying to think of what's...
Well, I think one very easy thing to reveal that we probably should reveal from the get-go anyways is the fact that it's going to be a date version.
Yep.
The number of people that complained about not having a date. And to be honest, the only reason why I don't have one is because there's no date. I always find myself looking for a date. You know, we kind of answered the call when enthusiasts were asking for a elegant tool watch, right?
Mm-hmm.
And these were all the purists that wanted the orange dial, no date. You know what I mean? We kind of answered that call already. But since then, like, this was back in 2018. Since then, not only has the landscape changed, but our market has changed as well. Mm-hmm. Our consumers, the Notice Fam has grown leaps and bounds, and the taste of the Notice Fam has changed, and we need to keep our finger on the pulse, right?
Yep.
And one of those things that keeps on coming up is the fact that the Avalon is a beautiful watch, but it has the one thing that they need in a watch.
Yep.
So that's why they can't get it. So we're doing that for sure.
So we got the 6 o'clock date window.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then,
of course. Have to.
More easily identifiable 3, 6, 9, 12 indices.
Yeah, for improved orientation.
Yeah.
Obviously, the case has to stay the same. You know, just the way it melts into the wrist. You know, that's the type of watch I imagine aliens wearing when they descend from their UFOs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just it's a part of their... Yeah.
And also... So the bezel on the original Avalon was 42 millimeters wide. The case was about 43. Yep. What we're actually doing is shrinking the bezel down to 41. I think it'll actually give it better proportions, and it'll be more manageable for the people who are a bit reticent to purchase it or even consider it because of the original size that it had. But again, like we've always said, this watch wears a lot smaller than the specs, but now it's going to be even more manageable. But at the same time, it won't really affect how big it looks on the wrist. It's only a millimeter, and it's only in the bezel grip, so it's not going to really affect the overall like presence on your wrist, but it'll still be more manageable for people.
Yeah. There are a couple more models, but there's really just one that I want to talk about left in this episode at least, and that is the Contrail 2, mm-hmm. just because it's right around the corner.
Mm-hmm.
Well, supposedly right around the corner. Do you have any updates on that? Because we're getting a lot of messages about it. So I want to just put in a quick update out on this podcast so that we can just, you know,
I mean, it's getting there.
Manage expectations.
The cases are all finished. You know, we just got to wait.
Yeah.
We just got to wait. Okay. That's all I can say.
Any update on an expected arrival date?
There's no expected arrival date at this point.
Okay.
Because the moment we say one, it's going to be different.
Yeah.
But this, the industry has been really affected, you know? It's not good for anyone, but that's just how it is, and we have to plan around that.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. But
do you have any insights in particular? I mean, I know you do, but I'm asking you a rhetorical question. What do you think, how do I put this? Have our suppliers and our factories said anything about the state of the manufacturing industry right now in China? And how much can we give away? How much can we safely give away?
Well, it's in shambles right now.
Mm-hmm.
Demand is...
By how much?
Demand is very, very low right now. So factories don't have a lot of orders. When the factories don't have orders,
and we're talking about the big Swiss companies, right?
Swiss companies, any company, like pretty much any of the large volume companies, brands that give these factories the majority of their orders, they're not ordering anymore.
Yeah.
And because of this, the factories need to work at very low capacity. They had to cut their workforce by a huge margin to not bleed money all the time, right?
Yeah.
So because of this...
Do you feel comfortable saying what that margin is, like how much they've cut back on workforce and output?
Well, every factory is different, right? But
yeah,
the wide majority of factories in China have been affected. They've probably cut their workforce in half or more simply due to not having enough orders to go around. And then I've been told, what I've heard through the grapevine is that if the demand doesn't increase for these factories, then the entire watch manufacturing industry in China will be cut in half by the end of the year. So half of the factories will be closed. To be fair, there are a lot of like small factories, small operations. So obviously those types of places will close. The big factories that, you know, make the good quality stuff will probably still stick around.
Yeah.
It's just
things. Is there anything we or any kind of brand that's at our scale, in our segment of the market, anything that we can do either individually or collectively to try to alleviate the pain that part of the supply chain is feeling?
Make more watches.
Make more watches.
These factories are
down with that.
They're scrambling for more orders because they have no work to do.
Yeah.
All the workers are on holiday.
To make more watches, you have to sell more watches too, right? So
exactly.
I guess it's
but this,
working both sides.
This segment of the market has been growing, but it still doesn't match the mainstream market, the non-watch enthusiast market in terms of volume.
Mm-hmm.
So ideally, we can, you know, brands like ours, you know, can keep some of these factories afloat. But I think the volume that we do is peanuts compared to the fashion brands, compared to
Yeah.
Swatch.
Yeah, well, I mean, they do like 5 to 10 million units a year. Yeah. That's insane. Yeah. Okay.
But, you know, just be positive, you know, hopefully this will run its course and then things will recover.
Yeah.
If it doesn't recover, you know, brands like ours hopefully won't be drastically affected in terms of like getting parts. It's just, we'll face longer lead times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I already know that there are some larger Swiss brands that have moved out of China. The last one that I heard was Tag. You know, they're manufacturing all their cases in Thailand now, where like manufacturing in China is a very easy thing to do because the skill is already there. They're already trained, you know, and they have experience doing this kind of stuff. But moving it to Thailand, that's like, man, I don't even know where I would start. If you and I were forced to move this thing to Thailand or, you know, and fill in the blank, you know, Bangladesh, Singapore, anywhere, any other country, like how do we even start, man? I have no idea.
But all I can tell you is that the watch industry is going to be very different starting 2021.
Yeah.
It's just going to look very different because either operations have died or just shifting demand for certain things or just a dwindling of demand.
So you seem to be speaking from a brand company point of view, but from the perspective of the market and consumers, do you think that they're going to see a difference or feel a difference in, you know, from all of this and any trickle down kind of effects that they're going to experience?
I mean, I think on the extreme side of things, we'll see bigger brands starting to do more direct sales, online sales. We'll see a lot of closures of ADs, retailers, because that model just doesn't work in the COVID world.
Yeah.
They need to cut out their overhead by a lot to sustain their operations. So that, you know, retail is the first to go, I would say. And we'll see brands approaching this with varying competency. Some will do very well. Some will completely fail because they don't know what the fuck they're doing. I think that's going to be a lot of them because they're Swiss brands and they're quite old fashioned that, you know.
Yeah, they've been out of touch for a while.
Exactly. So that's hard enough for them as it is. Like you see brands like Doxa trying to like doing direct only. To varying levels of success, I would say.
Yeah.
But Doxa is obviously a small company. They're essentially a micro brand.
Yeah.
They're essentially a micro brand.
Well, definitely in terms of their volume and the way it's run. Yeah.
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 But I think we'll see some wide sweeping changes in the retail model for watches.
Hmm. What about for our segment of the market? Do you think that there's going to be any tangible effects or will the buyers of micro brands feel or see anything differently next year and the year after? And
I think demand will shift. A proportion of that demand will shift down to our segment of the market. So we'll get more demand. So. Simply because the larger companies are less willing. They're risk averse, you know, like they're not going to be doing radical things right now.
Yeah.
So if you want excitement, you should look at the under 1,000 segment.
Yeah.
And,
well, I can tell you, and I can't remember which of these correspondents was private and which ones were public. So I'll just, for the sake of this podcast, I'll just say very generally that a lot of our fellow brand owners that happen to have stock and are not sold out, they've been experiencing record months, you know, since the whole shutdown, March, April, May, June, and they've never seen this kind of demand before. And, you know, on one hand, it makes me freak out a little bit because, you know, it's a bit like the stock market where there's no reason why it should be doing well and these companies should be doing well, but they are. What is it indicative of? I'm not exactly sure yet. I'm still trying to formulate my opinion on that, but my initial thought is that these buyers are buyers of much more expensive watches that still want to buy watches, but can't because, you know, no brand wanted to release anything this year. So, you know, they just, they go where their new releases and interesting things happening. And finally, I think they're starting to see that the independent sector of the watch enthusiast community and all the brands that serve that community, I think they're starting to see that that's where all the interesting things are happening and have been happening. So maybe that's why.
Yeah. And you can't ignore
probably it. Right. It's a great thing. Yeah. Yeah. You can't, you definitely can't ignore it.
You can't ignore just the sheer price difference of these products. Like, yeah, our watches are literally 5 times, 6 times, 7 times cheaper than what a lot of our customers are wearing, but they still buy it.
Yeah.
So why is that?
Yeah.
Simple. I think it says more about our watches than their buying habits, right? It's,
yeah,
is that they can actually compete with each other. Mm-hmm. And people are realizing that that price difference they're paying is kind of bullshit.
Yeah.
Obviously there's a need for the luxury brands, the Rolexes and Omegas, because mm-hmm. that fulfills, you know, a very, very specific emotional, tangible like need. But
yeah,
when it comes to just pure watches, like, you can't ignore the under thousand market.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Yeah. Anyways, I think that's an episode.
Yeah.
It's almost lunchtime and I'm starving. I've been fasting, just drinking coconut water, so I'm gonna go and feast.
Okay. Yeah, I haven't eaten yet either. So.
I've also been up since 5 today. My jet lag is still really bad. Oh, yeah. 2 weeks later.
I forgot to ask you, but 5 a.m. is not that bad. That's pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, it's very irregular though. Like, I was up at 2 yesterday.
Oh, God. So. Okay.
I don't know, man. It's kind of nice being up early. Like, I started running,
mm-hmm.
and you know, since the beginning of my life, I've been pretty adamant against running.
I mean, how's,
earlier in my life,
how's your knee?
I hated it.
How's your knee?
Well, yeah, yeah. So like later on when I started actually learning about the body and how it moves and all that, I've done a bunch of research on the long-term detrimental effects of running. You know, and obviously there are a lot of different factors you have to weigh, but at this point, because everything is closed, I would rather sacrifice a bit of knee health and keep my overall, you know, cardiovascular and mental health in check than to not do anything at all, you know, because there's no chance I'm going to a gym for the rest of the year, probably.
Mm-hmm.
So at least probably longer. So I've been running on concrete, on flat concrete. And, you know, I'm doing what I can to mediate the damage that's being done to my knees, but you know,
how long are your runs? It is what it is.
3 miles.
Jesus. Okay. Next time I come down, I'm going to run with you because I need to run.
Okay. But yeah, in any other situation, I would recommend fucking stay away from long distance running. But you know, it is what it is, man. This is a new world and we need to start learning how to adjust to this new world because it's probably going to stay this way. If not forever, then for a very long time.
Mm-hmm. All right.
So I guess this podcast is going to go full remote from now on. And I'm only going to see you on a screen.
Well, maybe I'll see you next week.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe a jam episode, right?
I really want to do that, dude. I miss that. Like, yeah. I need that. That's been like too long since the last one.
Cool. We'll do it.
All right.
I have some beer from Jason anyways that he wants us to share with different cups, obviously, because you know, there's a global pandemic and all. Anyways, have a good July 4th and see you next week sometime.
All right, man. You too.
Yep. All right. Miss you, man. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks again for listening to this episode. It's always fun catching up with Cullen, and hopefully we get to do that jamisode that you guys have been asking for. We've been doing what we can to adjust to this new way of working, and it's been pretty interesting to say the least. This crisis has provided a moment for us to recalibrate how we approach certain aspects of our business, and hopefully you guys get to see the results of that recalibration very soon. This week's thanks goes out to my very good friend Daniel Cheek, who had sent me a beautiful handmade leather strap for our new retrospects. I didn't get to see it until I got home, so it's been sitting in my drawer for about 2.5 months now. But first thing I did when I got home was take it out and put it on our new retros. And damn, it's nice. Daniel is the founder of Beckett Leather Goods, a boutique leather goods company that makes some of the best straps I've ever tried. Check out some of his straps at beckettleather.com. I'll put the link in the show notes. Cullen used to say that a new strap gives you 50% of the feeling that you get when you get a new watch. Well, Beckett Leather straps has gotten me about 90% of the way there. Highly, highly, highly recommend giving them a look if you need to breathe new life into your watch. I hope everyone continues to stay safe out there. Talk to you soon. See ya.